Mike Bloomberg, running for president, was in San Francisco last night with former Governor Jerry Brown. Earlier in the day, he was in Stockton, picking up an endorsement from Mayor Michael Tubbs on Insight. More from state government reporter Scott Rodd. He was in Stockton yesterday, too. And we'll hear part of Bert Johnson's exclusive interview with Elizabeth Warren, who was in Nevada on Tuesday. Also today, the challenge for victims of domestic violence when they need help. Multiple agencies, multiple stops. The Sacramento Family Justice Center was opened in 2016 as an all-in-one location. We'll hear more about this from Faith Whitmore and former County DA Jan Scully. Later, from the award-winning band Blame Sally, Monica Pasquale. She has her own solo musical project, a new album, a show this weekend with her bandmate, and this week's Sound Advice. I'm Beth Ruyak. That's Today on Insight. First, the news. From Capital Public Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm Beth Ruyak. We're glad you're finding us as NPR's special coverage continues. Our shows are online, they're available by podcast, and on air at 7 p.m. if the live coverage of that day doesn't run into the night. In a few minutes, we're going to get to California's new individual mandate for covered California health care plans, but let's start with the visits this week by two presidential candidates. They were in the region, Mike Bloomberg and Elizabeth Warren. State government reporter Scott Rodd was with Bloomberg in Stockton yesterday. He's in our studio now. Hi, Scott.
Good morning, Beth.
So Mike Bloomberg has been polling low in California. I'm curious about who came to see him and did they know about him or were they just curious themselves?
I would say a little bit of both. I mean, there's some name recognition there for Mike Bloomberg, but also, a lot of that name recognition is on the East Coast, you know, when he was mayor of New York City. So a lot of the people who came were curious. The people that I spoke to, it was a mix of curiosity and sort of wanting to see what this late, candidate entering the race had to say. And he received an endorsement from Mayor Michael Tubbs, Stockton Mayor Michael Tubbs, who he's gained some attention over the last year for doing some pretty inventive things. Largely, a lot of the attention is on universal basic income. So I think it was somewhat of an interesting endorsement for some folks. And this is what Mayor Michael Tubbs had to say about his endorsement of Bloomberg.
We have to have a candidate with the record, with the resources, and the relationships to not just make sure we beat Donald Trump, but make sure something like Donald Trump never happens again. In terms of record, Mayor Bloomberg served 12 years as mayor of the city of New York. And in that time, poverty did not increase. In that time, he innovated great programs around extending the earned income tax credit, building more affordable housing, creating more opportunity, and really making the American dream real for so many New Yorkers.
So I think two interesting things there. One is speaking about his record, specifically things that align with Mayor Tubbs' priorities down in Stockton, things like affordable housing, things like ensuring that people who are low and middle income receive assistance from the government, and pointing to Mayor Bloomberg's time in New York City as kind of the track record showing that that's where the proof is. The other interesting thing is, right off the bat, he makes it clear that his endorsement is partly practical. He wants to see someone who can beat Donald Trump. He wants to see someone with the resources and relationships to do that. So I thought that was very interesting that he led with that.
Some people might have thought Mike Bloomberg and Mayor Michael Tubbs. But if you think back to Tubbs' own race for the mayorship, Oprah Winfrey endorsed him. They already had a relationship, and Michael Tubbs had, coming out of Stanford, kind of a group of people around him watching his career path. So I think there's a connection there in power and people with Mike Bloomberg.
Yeah, I think that's fair to say. I think if you kind of think of it just right off the bat, you think Michael Tubbs and this East Coast billionaire, what's the connection here? Mm-hmm. But I think especially, when Bloomberg started to talk more about the policies that he wants to bring to the race, that's when you started to see some more of those connections. And this is what Bloomberg had to say.
To start, we're going to substantially increase the construction of affordable housing, both through tax credits and direct government spending, just as we did in New York. It cost money, but it turned out to be the right thing for New York, and New York thrived on it. We're also going to increase the supply of affordable housing by providing cities with a major new source of funding if they eliminate restrictions on zoning, particularly near transit areas, just as we did in New York. We're going to increase the number of Section 8 vouchers and make it easier for people who use them wherever they want to live. And we're going to increase the supply of supportive housing available to those who are homeless or need services, just as we did in New York. We'll also expand federal grants to cities that implement effective programs to prevent and reduce homelessness, something problem that almost every city across the country is suffering with.
And there you're hearing him hammer over and over, as I did in New York, as we did in New York. That's something that he's really pointing to say, hey, I had this track record. I had success in these areas in New York, and pointing to that as kind of the proof. That was something that came up time and time again. But it also, I guess, I wouldn't say came back to bite him, but there was also some controversy that emerged about his time leading New York, and that came up at the press portion of the event yesterday. And he was asked about his policy on stop and frisk. And that was the controversial policy that allowed police pretty broad authority to search folks who were on the street. And it ended up, it raised a lot of controversy. People say that it criminalized low-income neighborhoods and minorities in New York City. And actually a federal judge wound up ruling that it was unconstitutional. But he, you know, he said he took his best, he defended it by saying he took his best stab at what he thought was the best approach to lower crime and reiterated an apology that he had offered earlier, saying that it was ultimately not the right move. And Mayor Michael Tubbs also came to his defense and said, you know, I respect that he apologized for it.
Let's finish with a note about his campaign strategy here. He's not gunning for Iowa, is he?
That's right. He's skipping over Iowa, skipping over New Hampshire, and he seems to be focusing on Super Tuesday states. That appears to be his approach. And in a way, this is kind of what California was hoping for when they bumped up their primary and moved it earlier in the year. They were hoping that more candidates would come through and not just treat California as an ATM for fundraising, but actually trying to get out and talk to voters and, you know, essentially make their pitch to California. And Bloomberg entering the race late, that's his strategy here, coming to California, states like California. But also he's funding his own campaign, so he doesn't really need that money that's here in California. So a number of voters, a couple of voters said to me that they're glad that he had that approach coming out to California.
And then he went on to San Francisco last night at an event with former California Governor Jerry Brown.
That's right. And he didn't get an endorsement from Brown, but a lot of people saw it as a good little coup that he got, that he was sitting alongside Jerry Brown.
All right, Scott, thanks so much.
Thank you.
We'll check in again. That is Scott Rodd, Cap Radio state government reporter. You can find more from yesterday's event in Stockton at capradio.org. 2 days ago, presidential candidate Elizabeth Warren made what was her 9th campaign stop in Nevada. Cap Radio reporter Bert Johnson had an exclusive conversation with Warren after her event. He asked her, among other things, about the housing crisis across the country.
I have a plan to build about 3.2 million new housing units across this country. Independent economists say it would lower rents across the country by about 10%. And a big part of that plan is making sure that local communities get what they need. It's not about Washington saying, hey, here's what you gotta have and here's what it's gotta look like. It's about communities like Reno saying, look, here's our problem. Here's how we see the problem. And then Washington being a good partner and helping come up with the money. For me, this is about housing for middle-class families, for working families, for the working poor, for the poor poor, for seniors who want to age in place, for people with disabilities who want to live independently, and for people who've been incarcerated. We need housing for everybody in this country, because if you don't have good, stable housing that you can afford, pretty much everything else breaks apart. So I want to make that investment together, investment in hardworking people.
And how do you make that investment? Is that going to be from tax money or public-private partnerships?
So the money comes from going back to an estate tax on the people who still had to pay estate taxes back during the George W. Bush era. That's not so very long ago. And asking them to pay a little more and then making that money available both for direct investment, for example, actually building affordable housing, but also for creative ideas from the community. So let's just say, for example, Reno came up with, they had a whole section that they wanted to develop and put denser housing in, but they knew if they did that, they're going to have another public school. And that's an additional expense that makes the whole project not work. There'd be money in this plan to say federal government could pay for the public school. Federal government could pay for the exit off the freeway. Federal government could do the part it takes to help make this project work, with all of it driving toward communities that are trying to solve their housing problems in ways that work locally, in ways that drive down the cost of building new housing locally. It's about local expertise and some federal money.
That was Senator Elizabeth Warren talking with CAP Radio reporter Bert Johnson in Reno on Tuesday. I'll add a note about Bernie Sanders. He has a Women for Bernie weekend of events in the West. Saturday, he's in Las Vegas, and then he goes to Los Angeles the same day. Sunday, he's in Santa Cruz and then comes up to San Francisco. So we're going to continue to note the stops in the new year by presidential candidates in the region, and we'll bring you conversations with them as we get them. One more story in this week's Capital Chat. California has passed its own individual mandate law for covered California health care. There is a deadline coming up. CAP Radio's healthcare reporter Sammy Kaola is in the studio now with that story and the details about the deadline. Hi, Sammy.
Good morning, Beth.
I think we need a little bit of background on this.
Yeah, so the concept of a mandate, an individual mandate, came up during the Affordable Care Act. It was part of Obamacare, and it said you have to have insurance or you will pay a fine. And that was the law of the land. And then in 2017, the Trump administration zeroed out that penalty, which essentially means there's a fine, but the fine is zero. You don't have to pay. So that was effective 2019. So if you went without health insurance in 2019, you're not going to pay a penalty in 2020. Then Governor Newsom came into office and said, we need the penalty. We need this requirement that people carry insurance. I want to bring it back. So it went through the budget, legislation passed, and that is going to be effective during 2020. So if you don't have health insurance starting January 1st, you're going to pay a penalty in 2021 when you file your taxes.
So two issues that are raised is how steep is the penalty, and what does he mean when he says we need a penalty?
Sure. So the penalties range. It's based on your income. But if you're an individual, it starts at about $695. For a family of four, it can go up to a little over $2,000.
It's really steep.
So it's kind of a steep penalty. Though people can make an economic decision in terms of, do I want to buy health insurance, which, as we know, is also quite expensive,
right,
or do I want to just go without insurance and pay this penalty?
Mm.
And what we saw in 2019 when the federal penalty disappeared was that some people just chose not to go without insurance. They thought, I'll just pay this one-time penalty. And so Covered California, which is the state's exchange, they saw a 24% drop in new enrollment in 2019.
Hmm.
And they attributed that to the lack of a federal penalty.
Okay.
And so they said, we've got to put this penalty back. And they really supported Newsom on this and said, we need it because we need these people in the market. Because the people who tend to drop their health insurance tend to be the younger, healthier people who you want in the insurance pool to lower the costs for everyone.
Was the governor's full push about this aimed at making sure people are insured? Because there's another side to this picture.
So you would think on its face it's a universal health care push.
Yeah.
Get everyone insured. But at the same time, he wants to use the revenue from the penalties to create subsidies for people in Covered California. So people who are already buying insurance, but their premiums are very expensive. He wants to give them some aid so their premiums are cheaper. And this mandate is estimated to raise about $317 million in its first year. So he's banking on people paying the penalty because that's what's going to be the revenue raiser. And I talked to this health policy expert, Lanhee Chan. He's at Stanford University, and here's his take.
It seems like what he's doing is proposing a mandate as a pay-for. And that's not really why you would impose a mandate. The reason you try to impose a mandate is to enforce compliance, to broaden the insurance pool, to bring costs down. But again, we've tried that before, and it didn't work. So it's all a little bit puzzling, quite frankly.
So right now it is a law, though. Going forward, this is what we need to abide by in California.
Yeah, this is happening. It's completely passed and approved. January 1st is the beginning of that assessment period where if you're not insured in 2020, you'll be assessed in 2021 and you'll be fined. There are some exceptions. If you're uninsured for 3 months or less, you can file for an exemption because you were uninsured for a very short period of time. You're also exempt if you are below a certain income level. And then there are certain groups that are exempt, like Native Americans are exempt and non-citizens are exempt.
So here's where the deadline part comes in. In order to be covered by January 1st, 2020, what has to either be happening or have happened right now in December?
Right. So if you are uninsured right now and you want to sign up for Covered California, that's the state's exchange, you've got to sign up by December 15th in order for your plan to kick in January 1st. So then you'd be insured for, you know, all of 2020, presumably. You can keep signing up for Covered California after that, but it would mean you'd be going some of 2020 without insurance, and then you'd be at risk of paying.
So that deadline is this weekend. It's pretty simple to sign up. You can sign up online. However, it's remembering that this is the deadline and that if you don't have that coverage in place in January, you are vulnerable to this big new fine.
Yeah. So December 15th is coming up quick. There are about 3.5 million Californians that are estimated to not have insurance right now. Some of those people are eligible for Medicaid, but some of them make a little too much. So they'd have to go to Covered California if they're not, you know, getting insurance from an employer or something like that. And then there's also a big group of people who are not eligible for insurance because they're undocumented. So it's all kind of part of this puzzle of how do we insure all the Californians? And, you know, we'll see if this does it.
Okay. I assume we're posting a link to get to the Covered California website. Okay,
yeah.
Great. Thank you so much, Sammy.
Thanks, Beth.
Sammy Cayola is Cap Radio's healthcare reporter. You can find that link at capradio.org/insight. Up next, resources for victims of domestic violence. I'll talk with Faith Whitmore and Jan Scully. You're listening to Insight on your NPR station, Cap Radio. Welcome back to Insight on Cap Radio. I'm Beth Ruyak. For victims of domestic violence, elder abuse, human trafficking, sexual assault, even child abuse, trying to work through the legal system and get help from a network of agencies can be maddening, not to mention discouraging, maybe even defeating. In 2016, the Sacramento Regional Family Justice Center was established to offer some of these services in one location. Now, the holidays can be stressful. They can even be dangerous. So knowing about this center right now and the resources it offers, I think, might help someone in need. I'm joined in the studio by Faith Whitmore. She is CEO of the Justice Center. Hello, Faith.
Thank you. Hi, Beth.
Glad to have you here. The former Sacramento County DA, Jan Scully, is here, and she is chair of the board of directors. Hi, Jan.
Good morning.
Good to have you with us. So this became your key project and your focus as you were leaving the DA's office, but there was a long ramp up to this project. Why was it so important to you and imperative that it happen?
Well, family justice centers are the national best practice for bringing services to victims, as opposed to making a victim go out on their own if they decide to leave a violent environment, have to figure out all of the navigation, getting everything they need. It's impossible. They give up and they often return to that environment that at least they know. And so I've dealt with victims in the family violence area, particularly domestic violence, for my entire career as a DA. And so what was important to me is that we cared about them, but when the case was over, then we had to move on to the next case, and they moved on with no aftercare, no support system, nothing. And so for me, this holistic approach now on the community side, when a victim can come in, it's, we like to say it's a one-stop center where we work with her or him to assess what are the needs to give them the hope and the confidence to take the next steps forward. And so that, to me, is bringing collaborative agencies together, working together as a community. We just don't change that victim and that family. We potentially will profoundly change our communities.
What's the picture of the approach across the country? There are more than 100, in fact, many more than 100 justice centers across the country. And you would think maybe in Sacramento's case, being the capital of California, this should have been in place for a long time. What kind of coalescing does it take to make it happen?
Well, you really have to bring nonprofits together, public-private organizations that touch some aspect to provide some sort of service to these to these victims. And so that can be a challenge. People like to compartmentalize. They don't want to compete, those kinds of things. And so the FJC, really our message was we're not here to compete or in any way diminish the great work that's going on already in our community, but to complement and enhance. We need to be all working together so we don't have the gaps, so we can provide that service and support to that victim, because if she is successful, then we are successful as a community.
There is a span of services here, and I don't know which one of you can answer this better, but how does someone arrive at the center who needs help? And then you walk through the doors and you look around, and how do you know where to go? Is there a navigation team that helps?
So what happens when a victim, first of all, we receive victims from all sorts of places and referrals. So the law enforcement, the court, sister, brother agencies, word of mouth, etc. So when a person comes into the Family Justice Center and there's no appointment needed and there is no cost, so I want to make sure everybody knows that so that won't be a hindrance. But when someone comes in, they meet with a case manager, and that case manager sits with the victim, listens to the story, tries to understand what that person might need in order to go from a place of danger to a place of hope. So they develop with that person a safety plan, whether the person decides to stay or to leave. Primarily, we want that person to be safe, because not everybody's ready to leave when they come in the first time, but our doors are always open. So we see people maybe not ready to leave the first time, but they'll come back, and maybe even a third time. So we're there for them. And then we determine, for instance, if she doesn't have shelter, we will call one of our partners. Weave is an excellent partner, my sister's house, who can offer that service. If they need help with transportation, we can provide that. If they need social services, we will take them there. So everything that we do is a warm handoff, or we have people, some of our partners are right there in our center co-located with us.
The Family Justice Center is in Sacramento County. Is it only open to people in Sacramento County?
That's our primary geographic area, although we have seen people from other regions, and we do help them or refer them and make sure that they get the help they need.
I want to get back to this concept of safety. Mm-hmm. What makes a place safe, and how do you try to ensure that? And that also implies that people coming in are often in some sort of state of fear.
Absolutely, they are. A person who is afraid in their own home, and I know you interviewed Rachel Louise Snyder, who often says that the most dangerous place for a woman is in her own home. So what we do with that person, how we help that person, is to determine, can she be in that place? If not, where does she need to be? Often there are children involved. So what are the options for that person? We do offer free legal services for temporary restraining order petitions. And if in that the court grants a move-out order, we help that person to be safe during that period of time. And then perhaps she and the children can stay in the home. But otherwise, we will make sure that she gets to a safe place.
I'm looking at essentially a brochure about this, and listed under where to turn is everything from hotline numbers to service numbers to shelter services, suicide prevention, law enforcement. You talked about agencies needing to be on board or nonprofits, Jan, but law enforcement had to be an important arm of this as well. And did it impact some changes once the doors were open to the center?
Oh, law enforcement has been a partner since the very beginning of the idea of it and moving forward to the planning and implementation and establishment of the Family Justice Center. Law enforcement is co-located at our center.
On Power End Road.
Mm-hmm. Yes. And so the law enforcement piece, the public safety piece, is hugely important because, again, they just don't go out and arrest. They are there to protect and assist. And so we call on them often, and especially, Faith, you might want to mention the lethality assessment mm-hmm. in connection with the safety of the victims. Mm-hmm.
Every case manager sits with the victim and goes through a 20-question survey to determine what level of danger she is in at that time.
Is that the danger assessment?
The danger assessment,
that
right.
That Rachel talked about,
correct.
Rachel being the author of No Visible Bruises.
Right, mm-hmm. Thank you. Yes, that is. And what happens, questions such as, you know, what we wouldn't be surprised, is there a gun in the house? Are there drugs being used? But questions also such as, do you have children who are not his? Has he, and I'm using he, she in that way, but has he threatened suicide? So these 20 questions, what often happens is when she's taking this survey, she's shocked to see the level of danger that she's actually in because she's normalized this behavior in order to survive. And so we help her understand that it's really a serious situation. And we give a lot of credit to these people to say, you know, you're a survivor. You have made it this far. We want to help you make it over the next step because you have recognized something that has changed and you need to get out. And I want to say in follow-up to Jan, we do have detectives from the Sacramento Police Department, Sacramento Sheriff's Department on duty 5 days a week in our center. And they're wonderful because they are a resource to our staff. They are willing to sit down with the clients to discuss options and scenarios. So law enforcement has been, and we have great partnerships with all the law enforcement agencies in Sacramento County.
That's Faith Whitmore. I'm also talking with Jan Scully about the Sacramento Regional Family Justice Center. We will post a link to it on our website. It's located on Power and Road. Everything is free. No appointment is needed. Jan, I actually want your take on Faith's background because Rachel Louise Snyder made a point of saying that to have a member of the clergy, Faith having been a pastor for most of her life, in place at the center meant something significant. In your view, what's the value? What does that mean?
Well, it's hard to separate minister Faith from the person Faith because that was her calling and that's who she is. And the beauty of a Family Justice Center is we're very victim-focused, victim-centered. We don't tell them what to do. We work with them and try to hear what they want to do. So we're not caring about, it's not about us, it's about them. And a minister, in terms of taking care of their congregation, their flock, are always caring about not really the holistic group, but the individual. And Faith is just brings so much to that, and her demeanor and her tone. It's not threatening, it's calm. We have a victim survivor on our board that participated in the interviews for our CEO. And Faith was the quietest, but she was impactful. So we asked her perception of our victim survivor. And she said, you know, she's soft-spoken, but there's just a quality about her that touches me. Mm-hmm. And I know that she'll make a difference. And she has.
We have focused most of this conversation on domestic violence, but I listed a number of other areas of the experience of a victim. Where are we trending? We hear much more about human trafficking, but also elder abuse. In terms of any of these areas rising in terms of victims in need, can you identify what's happening?
I think people will be surprised to hear that over 10% of the people who come into our center are elder abuse victims. And those are people, not financial abuse, but physical abuse. And that's heartbreaking to see. So we have set up a lot of networks to help that population. Human trafficking is a very significant issue in our community, both labor trafficking and sex trafficking. We focus more on the sex trafficking, and we work with five agencies in Sacramento that do phenomenal work. And among those are City of Refuge, CASH, which is Community Against Sexual Harm, Bridge Network. So we work in partnership with them, and they see it every day.
I guess, can I just add one thing? And I'd like to remind people that we have each of those categories, domestic violence, sexual assault, human trafficking, elder abuse, child abuse, under the umbrella of family violence. And what people forget when they focus on human trafficking, well, there's a DV victim right there. And people don't appreciate the overlap and the interfaces of all the relationships here. The people that I would send to prison for violent or serious crime, 90% plus of those victims or those bad guys actually had a history of growing up in a violent environment.
This is what Rachel said was eye-opening to her. She was looking in this direction and realized, oh, everything else must be happening in that direction, too. By the way, we are going to re-air the conversation with her on Monday. It is powerful. It's informative. And I think around this time of year, especially, which is tense and difficult and stressful for a lot of people, maybe this will be helpful to someone in crisis. And we're going to post a link. Before I let you go, and Jan, I think you knew I was also going to ask for your reflections in your time since being DA. You left office in 2016?
End of 2014, actually.
End of 2014.
Yeah,
wow.
It's been that long.
A few years have gone by. The capital city has gone through the experience of the Stephon Clark case and a lot of what has been opened up, dialogued about, struggled with in this community. Could I get your take on what Sacramento has been experiencing and what you watched happen like everybody else did across this region?
It's been a bit depressing, but I think that it just hasn't happened to Sacramento. It's been all across the nation. And sometimes you have to finally pull off scabs and communities have to go through that painful part before they can start trying to grow again together. And I see examples of that in our community and elsewhere, and that I'm all about hope, and I'm an optimist and idealist. I believe in our district attorney. I've seen the outreach that she's done in ways that since that time she's worked together as a team with members of the community for a sexually violent predator case and some other kinds of things. And it's all about relationships and trust issues. And it's tough to be a cop and a prosecutor nowadays because of those trust and relationship issues. We need to step forward, continue to step forward, and we need to make sure that we're part of working together with the community members because we're best when we're together.
Have you continued to be in somewhat of an emeritus role? Have you stayed involved as a mentor, a sounding board in any sort of way, especially as the city worked through the last 2 years?
Maybe a little bit. I'm always available. But for me, my focus really is now on the community work of the Family Justice Center because it's really the community is really the group that makes the difference. And the community is there to support and be part of the team, of the public safety team. And when we start drawing lines and it's the community and the public safety team and we're not, there should be no boundaries. There should be no fences. And we're at our best, again, as I said, when we are together.
Well, thank you both. I had told Faith when Rachel Louise Snyder was here that we needed to have this conversation. And I think that's an ongoing need that we have to do so everyone's aware of the resources, because I think you don't expect that you could be the one in the situation and then suddenly you are.
And you know what we like to say is, whether it's the victim or it's family members or friends, whomever, you just get them to the Family Justice Center. We'll take it from there.
Thank you so much. That is former Sacramento County DA Jan Scully. Thank you so much for joining us today. And the CEO of the Family Justice Center, Faith Whitmore. Thank you, Faith.
Thank you, Beth, for having us.
Again, we'll re-air that conversation with Rachel Louise Snyder on Monday on Insight. And those links will be at capradio.org/insight. You're listening to Insight on Cap Radio. This is Insight on Cap Radio. I'm Beth Ruyak. Monday at noon here on Cap Radio, you will hear live a homegrown holiday concert hosted by Kevin Doherty, produced by Jennifer Reason. Some of the finest musicians in the region will be performing for you, so tune in. Again, that's Monday at noon on Cap Radio. Friday night, this Friday, Monica Pasquale and Renee Harcourt will be in concert together at the Sophia. They are part of the Grammy-winning band from the Bay Area, Blame Sally. I think you might know this song if you're a fan. Actually, I know you'll know this song. It's Bird in Hand.
She was young and you were too, but your heart was cold and gray. Pretty lass, as clear as glass, a diamond for a day. You held her hand to the promised land, her fears you delay. Babe, you had a bird in hand, in that hand she stayed. Sweetest words she'd ever heard, they made her trip and sway. Took her down to the old red town where you had your wicked way. Morning came, nothing the same, her feet had turned to clay.
Bird in Hand by Blame Sally. The band members have their own individual projects. For example, Monica and the Handsome Brunettes with Monica Pasquale just released a new album, her sixth. It's titled You Can't Kill Light. And the concert at the Sophia is a CD release event, but also brings together a number of the musicians who have played together for years. Monica's here to share some tracks and bring us this week's sound advice. Hi there.
Hi. Thanks Welcome so much for having me.
I'm so happy to meet you.
Yeah, likewise.
So what's the experience of Blame Sally taught you or showed you about, I could be real broad and say about life, but every big experience has remarkable lessons for us.
Yeah. So, yeah, with Blame Sally, I think one of the really unique things was this was a project that was started with four women working really collaboratively. And as somebody who's been in different bands, the way that worked was really different. And I think that seeing how women work together, often looking for consensus, is quite different from a sort of top-down approach or maybe battling for who's in charge in bands that are more led by men. I mean, that's a big generalization, but that has been my personal observation, and I think it's been sort of wonderful to do that. So Blame Sally was truly a collaborative band.
How did what you just described get you to results or outcomes faster or differently?
Differently. Yeah, I think that we were never, nothing could ever progress to the next part until all of us were on board with it. And sometimes that could slow things down. But I think in a lot of ways, it helped us create something that we would all be happy with, you know. And the band, even though Tomorrow Night is not about Blame Sally, Blame Sally's been together for 19 years.
Mm. You endured a lot of life changes and
yep.
struggles with each other.
Yep. Yeah, Renee was diagnosed with breast cancer back in 2006. We were pretty new at that point. And at the very same week that she was diagnosed with breast cancer, my partner Tom was diagnosed with multiple sclerosis. Renee's doing great now. Tom, not so much. He's kind of had a long decline since then. But yeah, we have been through that.
So Renee's with you on stage Friday night. Who else?
So on Friday night, Dear John, Love Renee, that's Renee's other project. They're a duo, and they're opening the show tomorrow night. So they're going to do a set. And then in my band, the Handsome Brunettes, also from Blame Sally, Pam Delgado plays and sings. And then I have four other musicians who will be there as well, who I've worked with for many years, all of them.
Let's get to some of the music from the new album. It is a big release night, and let's start with the track titled Sun in My Eye, and then we'll talk more about it, okay?
Great.
Ah,
just begin to sing this song again, but I'm afraid it's too much to undo. I walked away from you. Can we just start?
Sun in My Eye from Monica Pasquale and the Handsome Brunettes, a brand new album just coming out. But you have a lot of roles in this solo project. It's your voice. It's your hand in the writing. It's your touch on the keyboard, on the piano.
Yeah, I wrote all these songs and did all the singing and a lot of the playing, along with BZ Lewis, who I have worked with for many, many years. He and I have done film music together. Oh, and actually, we won Emmys, not Grammys, but we did a, I know that was a
congratulations.
Little. Congratulations. Yeah, so that was, we've done music for film and television as well. And
I want to list that, though, because you've had shows on PBS, on the History Channel, on National Geographic.
Yeah.
I think in my mind it transposed Emmy into Grammy because of the music. But the truth is, being able to compose a soundtrack for some of these big projects is an exciting credential all its own.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. People do that all the time, by the way. But yes, it is. It's been a great opportunity to do all kinds of music. I studied classical music, so doing more composition has been fun. But
in the liner notes you write to BZ Lewis, you still make me laugh, and your musicianship thrills me more than ever. And that's the point. In studying classical music, underneath this all, there has to be a strength to the composition.
Yeah, yeah. Right.
Let's listen to another track from the new album. This is Feels Like Something.
Great.
I'm standing here and looking that way. A road runs between. You know what I mean? Your cap and your jeans, you know what I mean. For a moment it feels like something, but we keep on walking.
For a moment it feels like something. What did that mean?
You know, I wrote this song when I started dating again in my 50s.
Wow.
And I had never done anything like online dating before. And
And that's where, for a moment, it feels like
exactly.
Something.
Exactly. It's so, you know, it's very much of the modern age. I think dating, like everything else, has become much more transactional. And also this idea that, you know, oh, well, if that didn't work out, there's something else around the corner. And I experienced that on both sides of that equation, I think. But yeah, maybe that song, I feel like it's a very tender song with a little bit of a cynical edge to it.
Yeah, it is sweet. I think that realm can be frightening for people. But how'd that go? Did you just try that for a season? Or
I have dated quite a few different people, haven't found the one yet, but I've actually made a lot of nice friends. So
so you haven't given up on online
dating? I haven't
dating.
Given up, no.
Because for a moment, it feels like something.
Exactly.
Monica Pasquale is with me for this week's Sound Advice. Monica and the Handsome Brunettes have a CD release show tomorrow night at the Sophia. Such a wonderful venue.
Oh, I love it.
Such great voices and musicians coming together. Let's listen to another track from the album. This title, I love, Like You Still Own Me.
I'm gonna write
gonna stop it when I have to. When there's nothing more to say. Land of sun on the floor, smell of coffee, and all I cannot throw away. You keep breaking down my walls, walking through these halls like you still own me. I can recall the night I met you, when I didn't think I would get you.
I think your wisdom and experience in relationships really come out in the storytelling in this album.
Thank you. You know, I don't hold back. I think that is something that I may have a lot of other things I do or don't do, but as far as I put my soul out there in my music, I think.
What a beautiful segue to the last song we're going to talk about. I think it's the song that anchors the album. The album is named for it. It came from a very visceral moment that you were experiencing. The song is titled You Can't Kill Light, the same as the CD. Tell the story about the genesis of it, and then we'll listen.
Okay, and I think, you know, there are two versions of this song online. The original that's on the album, I wrote this the week before the inauguration in 2017. And at the time, I had been, you know, feeling really kind of in despair and worried about what was happening. And I didn't like that feeling. And one day I just woke up and thought, like, there have been so many times in this country when we have faced, and in the world, when we've faced oppression, when we've faced things, hurdles that seemed impossible to overcome. And I just started thinking about them, about women's movement, about Black Lives Matter, both, you know, I mean, I just thought of all the times that we've been able to overcome. And I wrote the song. I recorded it the next day. I mastered it the next day. And over the next 4 days, I created a video with the help of my friend Josh, who's a cellist in my band. And on Friday, the day of inauguration, I released this video, and it immediately got many, many, you know, thousands and thousands of hits on Facebook. Then, just real quickly, a year later, year and a half later, I had a remix of the song, and I did a video about all the wonderful women who were running for Congress. And I was so excited that most of them, most of the people that were featured in there did make it. So, yeah, it's been an empowering song for me.
Monica Pasquale, here it is, You Can't Kill Light.
We build a fire, a fire burns bright. You can blow hard, but you can't kill light. We come together, sometimes we fight. You can knock us down, but you can't kill light, you can't kill light. You can't kill light.
That is the song You Can't Kill Light, the original. The two videos, Monica, in the first take us back in time, the black and white photos. It makes me think about my grandmother and my great-grandmother and fighting for the right to vote, actually.
Mm-hmm.
The new video is so joyful and uplifting. Young women, contemporary faces, hopeful, wanting to run for office, wanting to be part of change.
Yeah.
Same song.
Yeah.
Two completely different places in time.
Yeah. But I think the feeling of the song really was that change is always possible, but and that it isn't something that is handed to us, but that it's up to us. And that's the way change has always happened. And it's always been movements of people saying, like, we will not allow this to continue this way. We are empowered and we are going to make a difference. And I think that we're sometimes disconnected from that right now, and that, you know, we're online a lot or on Twitter, but really it's been people like willing to go out into the street and say, this is what I demand.
Thanks so much for being here.
Thank you so much for having me.
Good luck with all the different projects and your life and your voice.
Thank you so much.
Monica Pasquale of Blame Sally and Monica and the Handsome Brunettes, a show tomorrow night. Thanks for joining us. There's more online at capradio.org. You Can't Kill Light by Monica Pasquale.